Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? We've got an amazing TwimmelCon AI Platforms event shaping up for you, and I wanted to share a bit about it. The event is going to be anchored by what we're calling keynote interviews. These are live podcasts recorded right on the main stage, and I'll be joined by some incredible guests. Here are three that I'm really excited about. One, Andrew Ng. I could not be happier to have Andrew kicking off this event with me. Andrew is one of my AI heroes, and no one has done more to bring new practitioners into machine learning and deep learning than he has. Andrew's going to be sharing a bit about what he's learned helping many businesses get productive with machine learning and AI, and also speak with us about where he sees the field going. Number two, Hussein Mahana. Hussein is the head of AI and ML at Cruise, the self-driving car company. Before Cruise, Hussein helped build Google's Cloud ML platform and Facebook's internal FB Learner platform before that. Hussein's going to be sharing some of the lessons he's learned building ML platforms from scratch at some of the most advanced companies in the space. And number three, Fran Bell. Fran leads a team responsible for data science platforms at Uber. These are use case focused ML platforms supporting application areas like forecasting, anomaly detection, NLP and conversational AI, segmentation, and more. Her platforms sit on top of Uber's Michelangelo, putting her in a unique position to speak with us about how low-level and higher-level platforms come together to support data scientists and developer productivity. Beyond keynote interviews like this, we've got a bunch of outstanding speakers lined up to share their successes and failures helping their organizations build and productionalize ML and deep learning models. If this lineup sounds interesting to you, visit twimmelcon.com today to register. Use the coupon code GREATCONTENT through July 31st for an additional 10% off of our special early bird pricing. Hope to see you at TwimmelCon. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Emma Strubel. Emma is a PhD student at UMass Amherst. Emma, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you, and I'm particularly excited to have an opportunity to talk to you now. Just a few days before you'll be defending your thesis. So the best of luck on that. I'm sure by the time this show airs, you will actually, it sounds like you'll be hiking someplace and on your way to being a visiting scientist at Facebook AI Research for a year before you start as an assistant professor in the Language Technologies Institute at Carnegie Mellon. So congratulations on all that, first of all.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's very, very, lots of exciting changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So how did you get to this place where you have so much opportunity like and focused on AI? Like what, tell us a little bit about your path and your story.
Yeah, so it was not at all on purpose. And actually, I have thoughts about that, which we could talk about if you want or not.
Okay. thoughts yeah, are always a good place to start.
Yeah, I didn't even know that like sort of grad school or like getting a PhD was really a thing that I could do until undergrad. And I had professors who kind of like maybe pushed me in that direction. I got involved in some undergraduate research. But actually, when I applied to graduate school, I intended to study sort of like computational biology. So I was actually interested in studying and like understanding sort of, like computational power of biological systems. But my relationship with my initial advisor did not work out. And I was like really fortunate to just be introduced to Andrew McCallum, who's my current PhD advisor, by someone else I knew in my PhD program. And then I started working with him, and I actually just like found that I really enjoyed the work.
So, what department are you in? The CS department, or?
Yeah, it's technically the College of Information and Computer Sciences. When I joined, it was actually the Computer Science department, but we've grown a lot. And that was also my undergraduate degree was in computer science and like a minor in math. And I also took some biology classes and stuff like this because I like biology a lot.
Okay, cool. Also at Amherst?
Nope. I actually went to the University of Maine.
I'm from Maine.
So yeah.
How do you kind of describe your primary research interests nowadays?
I'd say like the overall goal of my research is I want to build like, I want to bring state-of-the-art NLP systems to, like, actual practitioners who actually want to use them. And I actually think there's, like, kind of, like, a large disconnect here between, you know, people who are doing, like, state-of-the-art NLP research and sort of, like, chasing these, like, high accuracies on these benchmark data sets. Mm-hmm. But if you take these models that get really high accuracy on some benchmark data set, like, and then run them on your, like, actual data, like, yeah, your actual documents or whatever, like, that accuracy tends to go way down. And then similarly, I think people, like, the most accurate systems tend to be, like, also the slowest, oftentimes, sort of, like, the biggest models that take the most computation. So I guess, like, two angles of my work have been, you know, developing machine learning models that are as efficient as possible, so trying to get that state-of-the-art accuracy, but requiring, like, much less computation, and then also developing models that are going to be robust, so that we can train them on, like, the annotated data that we have, but hopefully those same models will also perform well on, like, data from many different sources.
And when you think about practitioners, are you thinking about any particular domain, or are you kind of tackling it broadly?
Yeah, I mean, it's generally, like, I hope that my research will apply to practitioners, like, kind of from any domain. That's the hope. So specifically, I've worked with collaborators in materials science, which has been really cool. So they're interested in being able to extract, like, recipes for new materials, essentially, from the literature. And so I've been working with them to try to develop models that can do that. And it's been really, really interesting.
Oh, interesting. So that use case is the literature has the recipes in it, but it's in English, if that's what you... if that's the language you're studying in, B, if that's what you can call what's written in material science academic journal particles.
And yeah, you're English trying to, that, like, I can't understand.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so you're trying to capture from there some representation of what the recipe is.
Yeah, exactly. Going from sort of the unstructured, it is English, yeah, research article text to, like, some structured representation that's, like, these are the material precursors, then, you know, you heat them for this amount of time, and then, like, dry them and add this other thing in, and then you get this result that has these properties. Uh-huh. So then you can, once you have that information, you can kind of, like, analyze it at a large scale to, like, possibly, like, our dream goal would be to, like, be able to generate new material recipes, like, given some target material, generating the recipe, because uh-huh. basically that's done through, like, trial and error research in, like, a lab right now, so it's a very slow and error-prone process.
Awesome.
It's a fun application because it has, you know, this is, like, how we're going to develop, like, sustainable energy, right? Like, these are, like, the materials that are used for, like, solar cells and stuff like this. So mm-hmm. it's a fun project.
You kind of describe this problem of, you know, having these state-of-the-art results in academic literature and practitioners not being able to use them. And you're primarily focused on, it sounds like, kind of the... I don't know, the generalizability of the results, but it also kind of speaks to, like, a whole, you know, repeatability in machine learning research kind of issue as well. Are you tackling that?
I'm not yet, but I actually have been thinking about doing something like that, like, sort of similar to this energy and policy considerations paper, uh-huh. Which I guess we haven't necessarily talked about yet.
But we will.
Yeah, but we will. Yeah, yeah. So that's something I haven't tackled yet, but I actually was thinking about doing an analysis of, like, well, I guess I was thinking about statistical significance in particular, which is kind mm-hmm. of like a related issue. So, like, in NLP, we don't usually measure significance of our results. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of, like, issues with people reporting the max number out of many random seeds, and then it's hard to repeat mm-hmm. these experiments.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think that's, like, a really interesting thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, since you spilled the beans, you introduced the topic that we're going to be talking about.
Sorry.
No, I'm just teasing. So this is a paper that it's a pretty recent paper, at least according to the most recent one that's up on archive. It was this month, right?
Yeah, I actually haven't presented it at the conference yet.
Okay.
It's like the speed of research these days.
Yep. And so the paper is called Energy and Policy Considerations for Deep Learning in NLP. And what conference are you presenting it at?
It'll be ACL. So it's the annual conference of the Association for Computational Linguistics. This is, like, one of the top, like, international NLP conferences. It's in Florence in July.
Oh, nice. That's a good one to go to.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, like, peak tourist season. So, like, I don't know if it's, like, totally the best time to go there, but we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't you
tell us a little bit about this paper. What were your goals in writing it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I talked about how one of the focuses of my research has been developing these efficient models. And so the motivation for a lot of that research is basically that we want, that we even want machine learning models to be efficient, and that we want them to be efficient because we care about the cost in terms of money, but also in terms of the cost of the environment, because just bigger models require more energy, which has more CO2 output, basically. So that has been our motivation in a few of the papers that I've written. But then I realized that no one has really quantified this, especially not in NLP. So there's been I don't know of any work actually really quantifying this in terms of the carbon footprint of training these NLP models. And at the same time, there's been this surge recently in NLP, or this, I guess, trend of training bigger and bigger models on more and more data. And these models are performing really well, getting really high accuracies. But they're just the computational resources required to train them are enormous, such that, a researcher like me, who's not currently at a big company like Facebook or Google, cannot afford, and I don't even have access to the hardware to train these models.
So we're talking about language models like GPT-2 or,
exactly.
Okay, Google just a couple of days ago, I think released XLNet, and some folks did a kind of back of the envelope analysis that concluded that it costs $245,000 to train that model.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's not that's accessible. Exactly.
Yeah, no, not really. That's a pretty large portion of an NSF grant. So basically we were inspired by, the fact that we didn't see people quantifying this. And I think there's been sort of an exponential growth in the actual energy and computation requirements of models recently. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to quantify that. And then also, I guess, talk about some conclusions based on our results.
Yeah. And so one of the things that that you do is kind of compare the estimated emissions for training some of these models with kind of the things that we usually associate with, environmental damage, or at least emissions like air travel and, car travel, things like that. What did you find there?
Yeah. So there's a number of numbers. I guess one thing is training one of these models in this particular way that's very sort of computationally intensive. So this is training a machine translation model using this new technique called neural architecture search, required basically multiple, three, four, I'm not good at doing math in my head, but multiple times the entire carbon footprint of a car in its lifetime, including fuel and manufacturing, which is ridiculous. And that's that's even more carbon footprint than the average American life. Mm-hmm. I guess, so I should say one of the things we did is we analyzed the total carbon footprint of basically my last paper, the research and development required to, develop the last model that I published.
Okay.
And that was just the carbon footprint of that, of the work that I did, easily doubled or tripled my personal carbon footprint last year, which I found super alarming.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. Were those the two models or scenarios that you were primarily looking at, that your NLP pipeline and this kind of transformer neural architecture search model?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say we looked at a variety of these, these popular pre-trained language models. So we looked at Elmo, BERT, GPT-2. And then we were interested in looking at neural architecture search in particular, because I think it's very computation. It's a very computation hungry approach. And I think the resulting benefit is relatively small. And so I had a feeling it would be kind of a drastic number. So I wanted to compute it and kind of maybe encourage people to be a little bit more responsible about, these brute force techniques.
Yeah. I've had a number of conversations with folks and seen blog posts, where folks try to capture, in this case, the case I'm thinking of, the incremental cost of training a model, per incremental percentage accuracy benefit or business benefit, and like try to encourage people to think about that, you know, as they're devoting resources to building out these models.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, it's not something that I hear people talking about a lot. And I haven't come across any particularly like rigorous way of doing it or, you know, frameworks for doing it or anything like that. And I'm wondering, in your research, were you somehow able to like, you know, really get into that kind of the incremental carbon emissions per incremental benefit and accuracy or something like that? Did you compare that across different techniques?
That's a great question. We didn't, but people should totally do that.
But I'm out of here.
I mean, I would be happy to do it too if I just had to, you know, find the time.
Yeah.
One of our sort of like takeaways from this paper that we write about is basically that authors should report numbers that make it easier to do that comparison. And so I think there's some pretty straightforward things that people could compute for like any machine learning model that would like allow us to compare sort of like how much computation is required basically to get that accuracy. And then it would be like super easy to just, yeah, compute those numbers. So if people could compute or report just like gigaflops to convergence, that's like a pretty easy thing. Like there's like a couple papers where they've reported that, like when they're trying to compare and show that their model is like better. But I think if that was just like a standard thing we reported alongside, you know, accuracy or whatever other metric, I think that would be like really, it's like not that hard. And it would just really allow us to make that comparison directly. And similarly, like something that's a little bit less straightforward, but that would be really helpful in a number of ways is reporting sort of like sensitivity to hyperparameters. Because like a lot of this energy use actually comes from sort of like how wasteful we are in terms of you know, tuning these neural network models that, you know, notoriously require like a lot of finessing and tuning. And that tends to be like, if you want to train it on a new data set, you know, you have to do some kind of tuning, but we do like a really bad job. This goes back to what you mentioned about reproducibility. I think we do a really bad job of like actually being really precise about how much of that tuning happens. And then how much is required. Like there's like, you know, there's a lot that goes into development of a model and development of a new technique.
When you think about this, are you thinking about it like from a pipeline perspective and, hey, you know, this is an iterative process and we're, you know, kind of playing with all these hyperparameters to actually get to a model? Or are you thinking about it like, I don't know if this actually makes any sense, but like somehow dropout is more expensive than, you know, something else from a, you know, technique perspective during training?
Oh, that's super interesting. No, I wasn't thinking about that, but dropout is like probably more expensive than like some other technique just because it's like way less sample efficient. Like if you train with dropout versus, I bet there's other like more direct regularization approaches. I was not talking about that, but if you want to collaborate on
something else for someone else to figure out.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. People should like listen to your podcast for like cool research ideas. Yeah, no, I was thinking more just in terms of like, if you want to take some like published model and then apply it to your data to sort of like a new domain, I think it's really hard to tell like how much tuning is actually going to be required. And people just don't report that. So it's both kind of like not super reproducible. You know, you'll say, oh, we did a grid search of these things, but like, I think it's not actually that straightforward always.
You know, characterizing the cost of just inefficiencies in the way we do this stuff. Like, you know, I'm imagining there's, you know, some set of techniques that, you know, people still do all the time that are like far from, you know, best practice or state of the art that, you know, probably just like throw, you know, tons of CO2 emissions out there for naught. Like, have you given any thought to anything like that?
That's interesting. I mean, so this is not exactly what you said, but something that came to mind is sort of, I think people are very eager to use like deep learning when they could definitely get away with like just like a single like logistic regression. So that comes to mind as like something where, people want their technology to sound cool and to use the coolest stuff. But yeah, I think for, you know, for some, yeah, for many tasks, you don't really need like a big, deep, fancy model. You can just do like classification, like a, yeah, shallow classification. It'll work fine.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, all of these questions are kind of interrelated, and I guess that goes back to the fundamental contribution of this work, which is, hey, we really need to be thinking about how much it costs us to get this incremental, you know, percentage of, you know, performance by whatever metric you're using.
Absolutely.
Like something like neural architecture search, where it's kind of, I guess it's going back to the reproducibility thing. Like, you know, take GPT-2, right? A bunch of people have reported like trying to reproduce GPT-2, and OpenAI hasn't said everything that you need to do to get the exact kind of results that they got.
Yeah.
Like, do you, you know, if you're trying to benchmark these things, do you even know like how close you are to the actual cost to produce their model? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think if I understand what you're saying correctly, it's kind of like, do we actually know what goes into training these? Like, are our estimates even reasonable? Like, did we?
Well, I guess, so part of the question, maybe taking a step back, like to train the neural architecture search-based model, presumably you actually implemented that as opposed to determine the cost analytically, or no?
Yeah, no. So yeah, I will describe to you our methodology.
Okay.
With the exception of GPT-2, actually, we basically took, so all the models we analyzed had open source code.
Mm-hmm.
We took that code. We like just had it perform training for like up to a day. And then we sampled like the actual energy draw of the GPU or GPUs and the CPUs and the main memory. So we're making the assumption that like the main energy draw from the computer is going to be from like the computational hardware essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then we extrapolated that based on the amount of time and the hardware as reported in the paper that they used to train the model.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so we didn't, because it would have taken, I mean, as I said, we
at least $245,000.
Yeah.
Right.
To like replicate the entire thing. But we figured this is like a reasonable way to estimate it. And I'm happy to talk more about like how we then convert that to carbon and stuff like this, because it's a little bit like, you just have to make a lot of assumptions along the way. But we figured it's like, we tried to make reasonable assumptions, and it's like, we think our estimates are like ballpark reasonable.
Did you run it for the day on the exact hardware that they said they used, if they reported the hardware that they used, or did you have to extrapolate to that as well?
Yeah, we had to extrapolate to that as well. But we did make an effort to use hardware that's like fairly similar. So like, so the GPUs that we used, basically have the same. So like one of the metrics like that's reported for a GPU is sort of like its maximum power draw. And so the maximum power draw of the GPUs that we were using is the same as the maximum power draw of the GPUs they were using. So,
okay,
yeah, I think it's like probably the power use is similar, and they're not like incredibly different. They're like, you know, similar age GPUs and stuff like this. But yeah, it wasn't, in most cases, it was not the exact same hardware.
And then in here, you talk a little bit about the ultimate source of the energy, like whether it's renewable versus gas, coal, et cetera. Like, how were you able to fit that into this model? Do the various like data center providers, cloud providers, do they report on this stuff?
Yeah. So they're not super transparent about it.
Surprise.
Yeah. And so these numbers, we got these numbers from, well, so for the cloud providers, we got the numbers from a 2017 white paper that Greenpeace did, and it seemed like they surveyed the companies and got these numbers somehow from them.
Okay.
So in our computation, we used basically the mapping from like kilowatt hours of energy to carbon produced, or like CO2 produced, as provided by the US EPA. Like that's like the average for power consumed in the United States.
Okay.
And so if you look at the breakdown of AWS's energy, and so like obviously like where the mapping from like electricity, the carbon footprint is very dependent on like these sources. So if it's from renewable sources, it maps to zero. And then if it's from nuclear, you know, it maps to less than from gas or coal, like much less. So if you look at the breakdown of energy resources as of 2017 of Amazon AWS, it like pretty closely mirrors the breakdown from the US. And AWS is like the largest cloud provider. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, we thought that it was a pretty reasonable estimate or mapping. Mm-hmm. So since coming out with this work, people from some of these companies have contacted me and let me know that these numbers are out of date and they're doing better now. We're considering doing an update like in the fall.
Okay.
Or something with more up to date numbers. And of course, something that we don't like address a ton in the paper is that a lot of companies are also moving more towards many of them. I know like Google at least is like 100% renewable. In terms of, I guess, I don't want to say renewable, but basically they buy carbon offsets to make up for like energy in their cloud that does not come from renewable sources. So that's good. That's probably better than nothing, but it's also not the same as like using actual renewable energy.
Yeah, but they are relative to the other providers, given this 2017 data, kicking butt on the renewable. 56% for them relative to 32 for Microsoft and 17 for AWS.
Yeah, pretty definitely. Good. It seems like they really care about that. And also like TPUs are actually, so all the numbers that we were able to compute were for GPU just because we aren't able to get the power draw of TPUs. I do think TPUs are much more, because they're better at doing this computation, they just like don't take as much time to do the same amount of training. Mm-hmm. So also a technology developed by Google that I think, is just like much more energy efficient than GPUs. So that's nice. Although it's a little sad that it's like, I guess they're all proprietary technologies, but TPUs feel a little bit more proprietary than GPUs because I can't like buy one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like probe the energy usage and stuff like this.
Oh, right. So you could not include XLNet in this paper. You just don't have enough information because all the data they provided was TPU based. You'd have to do a lot more extrapolation than even you've done here.
Yeah, exactly. So for like the BERT model, for example, this was also originally trained, at Google on only TPUs, but since then like NVIDIA retrained it on GPUs. So we were able to use like those numbers. But exactly. For XLNet, it's like unclear. Mm-hmm. Exactly what the footprint would be. I guess if I made like a follow-up update, maybe like a blog post or something, I would try to get some, hopefully if it's not too proprietary, try to get some like energy draw information for TPU so that we can do that estimate.
Right.
Because I think it'd be really interesting to actually see like how they compare concretely.
This work is very specific to NLP. Do you have any specific thoughts on like how it applies to, I guess the methodology is pretty general, and what you're really saying here is that we should be doing this, and that's another exercise for someone else is to apply it to computer vision models and the like.
Yeah. So there is, some other people have done work, comparing, in computer vision in particular, it's like a really popular area. Let's see, what were they looking at? So I don't know of anyone doing the mapping to like carbon footprint, but there are people who have compared sort of like the energy use, like the energy draw required by the GPU for using sort of like different neural network layers in, like these big image classification networks and stuff like mm-hmm. this, or like, different batch sizes and stuff like this.
Yeah.
So there's some work. They didn't do, you could take, I think, their numbers and then do like that extra step of mapping to carbon footprint. I do think like the NLP models, especially these like, notoriously enormous pre-trained language models are just like some of the most energy hungry models in machine learning. I would say like the other area that's probably just like using insane amounts of energy would be the work at like OpenAI on doing like training reinforcement learning models to do mm-hmm. like play various games. I think that's going to be like probably, I mean, I think the technique for training those is like kind of similar to neural architecture search, in that you're actually training like a ton of different models. And
you kind of, early in our conversation, there's a hint of judgment that, you know, the incremental gains that we're seeing, you know, going from, you know, one model to the next, ELMO to BERT to GPT-2 to XLNet, like, doesn't necessarily justify the increase in training costs. Like, did you try to quantify that specifically?
Yeah, so I think the question you asked earlier kind of would have quantified that, like, if we had just computed, you know, like, a ratio.
Yeah,
like, the difference in, you know, compute required versus, like, the increase in accuracy. We totally should have done that. Like, I think that would be nice, because a lot of these models do evaluate on sort of, like, some of the same metrics. Yeah, so we didn't really quantify that, except, yeah, that we noted for the neural architecture search that they get an increase of, like, 0.1 blue score, which is really not a lot.
Right.
On like English and German machine translation, yeah, at the cost of, we say, like, at least $150,000 in on-demand compute time. Yeah, I think that sort of that approach in particular is just like a very brute force approach. I do have like a little bit of judgment about
right.
that. I mean, I think like the gains.
So I didn't
like,
make that up.
yeah, it's true. ELMO versus BERT versus XLNet. You know, I do think that they are, like, there are actually pretty substantial differences in accuracy between those models on, you know, these like standard NLP benchmarks. And I think that that is important to do. Something like the neural architecture search, I feel like maybe there's like some more like well thought out research that we could be doing to like not just do a brute force search on architectures to find like really small increase on like a single language pair type thing.
Is there a counter argument or devil's advocate thing here that says like really the innovation in all these models is in their use in transfer learning? And if you think about that, the cost to train these models is amortized across lots and lots of users. And similarly, the incremental performance gains accrue across lots and lots of users, and so it's worth it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I am definitely not saying, you know, I'm an NLP researcher. One of the models that I analyzed is like my model.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to like stop doing research or something. Like, I'm going to continue working on these models.
Right, right.
And I do think like ELMO and BERT and like, I guess now XLNet, like, yeah, I mean, the accuracy increases on these core NLP tasks resulting from these models is like awesome. It's like really cool to be like in this field at this time.
Yeah.
So I'm like by no means saying we shouldn't be doing this research and we shouldn't be using these models. And so I totally agree with you that, yeah, that's like a great sort of like counter argument that, especially these models in particular, you know, they're sort of like pre-trained on this large amount of like data. They don't require like explicit supervision, so you can like kind of easily collect this large amount of data and then just train on it. And then these models are like really applicable in a lot of different, yeah, you can sort of provide them as input in a lot of different tasks. Yeah, I mean, that's totally true. I still think it's important to characterize like the costs. Especially, yeah, so like another one of our conclusions is sort of like in terms of like access to computation resources. So I do think if you want to use one of these models in a new domain, so they tend to be trained on like web crawls and like news corpora,
Wikipedia,
and
stuff like that. That kind of thing.
Wikipedia, yeah. And so I still think like the, so I'm sure if you initialize some model, let's say that you wanted to run on these like materials science journal articles, or like whatever, some like, yeah, research articles in a very specific domain. I think if you, you know, if you initialize your model with one of these models, like probably it will help. But what you really want to do is train one of these models on a corpus of that data, which is actually something that we did in our research.
And are you making a distinction between training and tuning?
Yeah, so we fine tuned. So that's true. You don't need to. Yeah, given the model itself, it's already learned a lot of sort of stuff about, let's see, if you care about English, it's learned a lot of stuff about you know, English that is sort of domain independent. I guess it probably is domain independent. Yeah, so that's a good point. You only need to fine tune it, but it still takes like a lot to fine tune it, basically. What I was saying is, yeah, basically, like in terms of like funding and stuff like this, yeah, just developing and using these models can still be pretty expensive for like academic researchers, or even, you know, just, you know, smaller companies and smaller groups who want to use this technology, but just don't have a ton of money or a ton of resources. So it would be nice to have sort of like public resources or something so that people have more access.
Any other takeaways or conclusions that are worth noting or exploring in this paper?
So there's one other thing that we talked about in the paper, which I guess I maybe touched on a little bit earlier. But like, I think that we already have, so like when I analyzed like the model that I trained, a lot of the cost was just like, yeah, doing this like tuning and development and stuff, basically doing these like just grid searches of hyperparameters. So like, just like considering like every pair of, or every like combination of like K hyperparameters, which is like a really dumb approach. It's really like wasteful. And we have techniques, you know, like Bayesian hyperparameter search and other stuff that are better. But at least in my experience, like most people are not using them. So I know Google has like an internal tool that does this. So people do it at Google, but yeah, their tool is like not open source, for example. So I think like another thing that would be great is if these big like deep learning toolkits that like everyone is using, like TensorFlow and PyTorch, et cetera, you know, made more of an effort to build in these more energy efficient approaches that already exist. So it's like easier for people to do more efficient modeling. That would be great.
Nice. Shout out to our friends at SigOpt that does this for Bayesian optimization. But it's, I think another take on it, like they, you know, go in and are talking to people about like performance and, you know, making better models. And this is a whole different take on it and looking at the efficiency of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, that's, I mean, for me, that's like a big gain of, like Bayesian search is, just like being able to actually search the space intelligently.
Right.
Well, I guess, in terms of energy use rather than just like the accuracy. Right. And I think it's often like easier to show that, at least in my research, something I've enjoyed is like rather than trying to like make some number higher, I tend to be just trying to like match some number, but like make the model more efficient. And I think it's actually a lot easier to do that. Mm-hmm. Because like everyone's trying to make the number higher. It's at a certain point, it can be challenging.
Cool. Well, Emma, thanks so much for taking the time to share what you're working on. It's very cool stuff and an important paper for sure.
Yeah. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm really glad because I think it's a really important thing for people to think about. So I'm grateful that you invited me on the podcast to talk about this so that we can get some more visibility and more people thinking about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess one more thing that I would like to say is that there's been kind of like a lot of discussion about this paper online, and we want to like encourage that discussion and provide, you know, like a place for that discussion to happen. So we were going to upload the paper on OpenReview, which is like a forum where you have like a paper and then you can have like discussion by people. So I'm planning on doing that like today or tomorrow. So maybe we can
awesome.
Link or something. But yeah, hopefully if people want to like discuss more, I'm hoping to provide a forum for that to happen.
Okay. Well, yeah, shoot us the link and we'll include it in the show notes page.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emma.
Thanks.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on today's show, visit twimlai.com/shows. Make sure you head over to twimlcon.com to learn more about the TwimlCon AI Platforms Conference. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.